Hey guys, Norm here. I hope that this episode finds you well. In fact, this is probably one of my favorite episodes of the Tokyo Lens podcast that I have recorded in at least the last half year to a year. I really encourage you to sit down and listen to this one all in one go if you can. And if you were ever going to share an episode of this podcast, I would love it to be this one. If you have anybody at the end that you think that this podcast would give value to, I would absolutely love it if you would take a few seconds out of your day to share it with them. So without any more buildup or anticipation, let's jump right into today's episode. Hey guys, welcome to the Tokyo Lens podcast. And as always, if you're a regular listener, welcome back. Today, we're going to be talking about a small variety of topics, but all serving one common theme. So in order to get into this, let's jump back a couple months. To be specific, I'd say about 6 or maybe 7 months. Yeah, we're jumping back to October. You see, in October, I did a podcast episode talking about Halloween and warning about the dangers that come along with Halloween and its ever-growing popularity here in Japan. So for those of you who haven't heard that one yet, I'm going to give a quick and very simple recap. Here in Japan, over the past couple of years, Halloween has grown increasingly more popular. And every year, it's changed just a little bit. About half a decade to a decade ago, it wasn't uncommon to see a bunch of people gather on one Yamanote Line train car, usually one of the ones at the end, and use kind of forums and message boards to communicate where they would be and wear costumes and drink. And the party slowly, over the years, shifted to Shibuya. But with the growth of the popularity of Halloween here in Japan, especially in an area that gets as crowded as Shibuya, comes along with it a great deal of problems. One of the biggest of which is the issue of mob mentality. And one of the biggest mobs that you will ever see is that of Shibuya during Halloween. And this is a particularly rowdy mob, if you will, because of the addition of alcohol. And so last year in October, when I did this podcast episode, one of the things that I had included in it was a little bit of a warning that things can get crazy and that it's better, especially if you want to avoid trouble, to perhaps even avoid the area or just be careful who you are with in the area. And shortly after Halloween itself took place, things did get crazy. There were news stories about it. Just Google Halloween Shibuya 2018 if you want to see some of the specifics. But just recently, some news came out that this year in 2019, the police are actually going to be banning drinking in the streets of Shibuya. Now, this isn't going to be all streets, but it's in an effort to circumvent some of the issues that came up last year. One of the reasons that I'm opening with this is because I expect to be seeing over the next couple of years a lot more changes implemented in this way. You see, one of the things that caused the change for this year is the simple, immense crowds that were hitting Shibuya and the addition, obviously, of alcohol, but the crowds in their own. I highly, highly encourage you to Google it and take a look at some of the articles. They do show some overhead shots that are unlike any shot of Shibuya Crossing that you will ever see in your life. From edge to edge of every single building, there is people filling the entire crossing. It is beyond anything that we usually get to see. Now, this massive crowding, this overcrowding, overgathering is the word I think we'll use today, is becoming an issue across Japan in general. You see, after the March 11th earthquake in 2011, Japan invested a great amount of resources, time, and money into increasing tourism. And we have talked in some detail before about how this over-tourism is impacting Japan. But things that we haven't covered inside of this are the small side effects that are coming along with it. You see, while the Halloween situation isn't necessarily representative of tourism, it is representative of a shift that is happening in Japan. Now, if we shift the talk itself back to the over-tourism area, for example, there are entire areas or temples and whatnot in Japan that are starting to reject large groups of non-Japanese visitors. A good example of this is the Nanzoin Temple in Fukuoka. They've actually put up signs in multiple languages stating that groups over a certain size will not be permitted to enter. And this is something that anybody who's spent any amount of time in a touristy area, such as myself and all my time in Asakusa, can attest to having a very large impact on any given area. For example, so I lived in Asakusa for the better part of 10 years. In the time that I lived there, I watched the entire area transform. You see, one of the biggest sources of tourism dollars in Japan is the tourism dollars that come in from China. And more than anything, it's a numbers game. It is a game of pure volume. They come over in large groups with friends and families on discounted flights and spend incredible amounts of money on everything from Japanese cosmetics to Japanese baby goods like diapers and everything, Japanese food, you name it. And so one of the things that you notice is, for example, in areas like Asakusa, the prevalence of large groups that block the road and stop you from getting through the road, or large tour buses parked off the side of the road. So if you're driving, you can't even get through there very easily. These are everywhere. And I think that that's an obvious statement, but it's the minor changes that affect the people who are there the longest that you start to notice. For example, a lot of my favorite shops or restaurants in the area became inaccessible or disappeared altogether. A great number of older or more traditional shops that perhaps weren't doing so well in business but were still a staple of the area got very quickly converted into drugstores, because drugstores are a huge pull for Chinese tourism dollars. In fact, a large majority of Asakusa has just become drugstores. Some of my favorite spots in Ueno's Ameyoko Market, whether it be game centers or old restaurants, used clothing stores, all of these spots that I once loved, every single one of them has turned into a drugstore. And it's these little once upon a quintessential spots in the area disappearing has impact in its own. But when you see that they're replaced with drugstores and you walk into the drugstore and there's just as much posted in Chinese as there is Japanese, you have an understanding that this drugstore obviously has a certain goal. In fact, many of them will even have staff standing on the streets holding signs written entirely in Chinese that have advertisements and discounts and everything. And in all fairness, they do sell stuff reasonably cheap. Some of them have fantastic sales. I ended up in my last couple weeks in Asakusa doing a lot of my beverage shopping at some of these drugstores because I could get cases and cases of certain types of tea or carbonated water at incredible discounts that I couldn't get anywhere else. But there's also the restaurants. For example, some of my favorite restaurants have just shut down groups altogether. They've made it so that if it's not a regular or like a small group of regulars, you basically can't get in. I had my mother and father and a whole bunch of friends and everybody. I think there was like 7 or 8 of us, and we went to go into one restaurant, and they were just like, no, sorry, we cannot accept a group your size. And the restaurant wasn't full. They just weren't willing to accommodate the group. But even more disappointing, I think, than anything, was there was a yakiniku or Korean barbecue restaurant that I used to absolutely love. And they kind of went in the exact opposite direction. You see, I had been going to that particular restaurant since somewhere around late 2007. I loved it because while the quality wasn't fantastic, the restaurant itself was rather spacious. And the food was okay, but it was really, really reasonably priced. The last time that I ever tried to go there was probably about a year and a half ago. And when I walked in, they were like, no, sorry, we don't accept regular customers anymore. We only cater to tourism groups. I had a friend visiting in from Canada with me, and I was like, well, it's just the two of us, is there absolutely no way that we can get in? And there was like, no, I'm sorry, there's nothing we can do for you whatsoever. And that was kind of a heartbreaking moment to me, to have one of my favorite restaurants that I had been going to for at least a decade at that point to just straight up say that I was basically not welcome there anymore. Now, Japan has started to adjust to the tourism, for example, in its own way by adding a departure tax. Now, this is something we may have covered, but I don't think we covered in any detail. Foreign visitors are actually charged 1,000 yen on exiting the country. The overall goal of this 1,000 yen departure tax, as it's being called, is to kind of expand and enhance the country's tourism infrastructure. Now, this is one way that Japan thinks that they can help deal with this massive tourism boom. But I think more than anything, the responsibility kind of falls on us. Obviously, large group situations, there's not a whole lot that we can do. Maybe not come with a large group, but in the end, that I think that's far outside of the individual's control. But I think that there's something much more we can do. And it's simply exploring the areas that are not typically explored, exploring the unseen, the unknown. You see, no matter how far into the countryside, Japan's railway system has made the entire country incredibly accessible, which is one of the reasons that in that previous episode, I put together a list of places outside of the major spots of like Tokyo and Kyoto and Osaka that are fantastic to visit. And to be honest with you, that entire list, more than anything, was just the tip of the iceberg. Now, I will eventually do an entire piece of content, most likely in video form for the Tokyo Lens channel, showing just how easy it really is to travel the country without any level of Japanese skill, because that is a concern for most people. What if I can't speak Japanese and I go into the countryside? Am I going to be able to communicate? Am I going to be okay? And I've talked again and again about the hospitality and the level of support that is available everywhere you go, but also there's technology now that we didn't have back in the day. For example, something as simple as Google Translate. Even if you do not have a SIM card or Wi-Fi with you, you can download both the Japanese dictionary and the dictionary for whatever is your native language. I'm assuming you speak English since you're listening to this podcast, and you can have that with you at all times. While it might not be fantastic for translating full sentences, you can use it to get close enough with keyword conversations. So about a year or so ago, I went out to a village called Noto in Ishikawa. It's a piece of content that I really enjoyed making. It's a place that I really enjoyed visiting. And after releasing that video, I had several people comment and email me saying, hey, I actually had the chance to visit Noto. And my favorite message out of all of those was a gentleman who said his biggest concern was going into the area with zero Japanese skill. He was just visiting Japan for a short time, and he said, I went into the area incredibly nervous, and everyone was so friendly, kind, and supportive. They used their broken English. I used the 5 Japanese words that I knew, and I ended up leaving 3 days later with incredible memories and a full belly. And that was a really, I can't even remember if that was a comment or an email, but he went in with the right mindset. But the other thing that I want to say is that if we are going to collectively, as a group of us, as a group of listeners, if you will, explore these areas outside of the main tourism spots in Japan, we take along with us the responsibility of keeping that individual mindset, keeping the level of respect. And I feel that all of this, I don't want this to come off condescending whatsoever, because I think all of this is very, very obvious things to say. I don't think I need to say to any of you, let's go into those areas and be clean, respectful, not throw out our garbage, not talk on the trains. All of these normal, simple Japanese basic etiquette things should be fairly easy to understand. But also, if you have specific hobbies or interests or something that you like, make sure that you understand how that relates to Japanese culture. For example, if you are a photographer and you are going to photograph temples and shrines and stuff like that, while the larger areas like Tokyo and Kyoto will be completely accustomed to seeing tourists come in with cameras, keep in mind that smaller areas may not. And it can really be as simple as making eye contact and greeting whoever's managing the temple or behind the glass or whatever it is with a smile and a konnichiwa. Just being polite and smiling and maybe even being nice enough to hold up your camera and say photos okay right there. If you say photos okay with an upwards intonation, that's enough for most people to understand if you're pointing at the camera that you're checking if it's okay. And that not only serves to make sure that you're not breaking any of the rules, but it also makes you come across as more approachable and friendly to them, so that when you've left, you've paved the way for the next visitor they see to not have a bad situation. I often get asked, well, why did you leave the area of Asakusa? And I had about a billion reasons. The biggest was I just needed change in my life, and I knew that I wasn't going to move on to that next step of my life without a major change. I'd grown attached to Asakusa, but it was also the fact that Asakusa in its own was changing. Any area that's faced with that level of tourism, you don't want to fit into that crowd. You don't want to be one of the members of that crowd. You don't want to be seen as one of those people who's throwing the garbage on the ground and this, that, the next thing. And you kind of want to separate yourself from that. And we can separate ourselves from that if we're visiting these areas outside of Tokyo, these smaller countryside, rural, hidden little spots. We can have our adventures and we can pave the way for all the adventurers after us to have an even better time. And what's more is that as we do this, we can support these smaller local areas that truly hold the heart of Japan itself and help fight against a continually growing struggle that Japan has of these local economies and therefore these local areas and their history fading into history. Each one of these areas is an example of Japan's core and its history, the one thing that led so much of us to fall in love with Japan. And each one of us individually can contribute to the country's success as a whole and help keep not just the areas, but the culture and the history of this country alive simply by making a small shift in our expectations and actions when we come and visit the country. I'm not saying don't visit Tokyo, don't visit Osaka, don't visit Kyoto. I don't mean that by any means. What I am saying more than anything here is that there is much more value to be held to you and to the country of Japan than you can possibly imagine by adding more than just these main places to your itinerary when you travel. Now, one of the reasons that I'm bringing this up is an article that I was reading the other day that I'm not going to be going over in this came up. It's actually been pretty much everywhere on Japanese news, all over the internet. A gentleman tourist decided to fly his drone in Shibuya over Shibuya Crossing. Now, I'm sure that for most listeners, you probably sit there going, yep, there's always that one guy. And it really only takes that one guy. You see, the whole thing ended up safely. The police found who he was, et cetera, et cetera. There's, as I said, articles about it all over the place, but all it takes is for that drone to malfunction, or for him to lose control, or for a bird to hit it and knock it out of the sky. There's any number of things that could have gone wrong. And you look at a drone 30 to 50 meters up in the air and that thing falls out of the sky, it's going to do some damage. If that hits someone young enough, it could kill them or even cause a car accident that could lead to someone getting hurt. In Japan, that's actually a very, very leading cause of pedestrian accidents, is a car coming up off of the road, more often than not, a taxi or a more aged driver popping up off the road and hitting a pedestrian. So I've kind of sidebarred a little bigger than I had initially anticipated in this one, but it kind of ties into the, if you have a particular hobby or interest, for example, if you are into flying drones, there are areas in Japan where you can fly drones. There are rules and laws no matter what area. For example, whether it's okay or not, you cannot fly at night. You cannot fly over a certain height. And making sure that you know these before you go in, so that you're not causing unnecessary trouble or potentially even putting someone else at risk, or even in the most minor of senses, making the visit worse for the person who comes after you. More often than not in human history, the warning signs that we have, for example, on a cup of coffee that says, caution, this beverage is hot, is because someone before us caused a problem. And I don't think any of us want to go to Japan and be that person to cause a problem. And this episode isn't meant to cause any fear or anxiety. If anything, the goal of this episode is to do the exact opposite, is to create a bit of awareness to make us realize that, okay, there are a lot of visitors to Japan. There are a lot of people who love Japan right now. And as we get closer to the Olympics, honestly, it's only going to get worse. It's only going to get busier and more crowded. But I think a lot of us, yes, we want to see Tokyo. We might want to see Kyoto and Osaka. But the question is, does it have to be now? And even if it does have to be now, that's okay. But does it have to be for 3 days, 4 days, a week? Or can we do Tokyo for a day, Kyoto for a day, Osaka for a day, and take the remaining 4 days in our week or the remaining 2 weeks in our vacation and explore the hidden little areas that are still very accessible in the other parts of Japan? Now, another reason that I'm selfishly pushing this idea is because the more I've traveled through Japan over the last year, the more I've realized that while these large cities like Tokyo and Osaka are benefiting greatly, there are all too many smaller cities that are suffering. Their younger generations, and I think this is universal across the globe, not just Japan, but again, it's an area that we can help. So many of the younger people are going into the bigger cities because that's where the education is and that's where the jobs are, which is leaving a lot of these truly beautiful, traditional Japanese towns, cities, and prefectures dying out. And along with it is the history that we all love so much. Even if you fell in love with Japan because of anime or samurai, ninja, whatever it might be, whether it was the music, all of that came from Japanese history and Japanese culture. And while you can get a peek of that in the major cities, you'll get a real feel for it, a real taste for it when you get out to those smaller areas. The more hidden, the more rural, the more inaccessible of the area you get to, the more you really start to feel Japan. What I'm going to do is I want to link the video about the Noto area in Ishikawa in the description of this podcast episode. And I want to do that because I believe that that video really paints a picture of how beautiful one of these areas can be. Now, obviously, if you are listening to a podcast, you're probably out and about in some way. You might be out, you might be driving to work, you might be at the gym. So obviously, I don't recommend that you load it up right now. But if you get the opportunity at some point in your day, make a mental note right now that when you get out of your car, when you get out of the shower, when you bring your dog back home, you're going to go into the description box and take a peek at this one video, because this video has kind of given birth to a lot of the content that we've seen here and a lot of the mindset that I have that the biggest reward you will get in all of Japan exists outside of the major cities. But I did want to hit this idea or this topic from multiple angles. I wanted to do this because each approach or each piece of content might hit each individual differently. The very first piece of content that I did talking about getting outside of Tokyo, that might have had the impact for you and inspired you to do it. It might have been the piece that I did where I introduced other areas around Japan, or it might have been this one. It's definitely safe to say that as humans, sometimes we just need to hear things multiple times from different angles for it to finally sink in or get the point. But if this is that one piece of content that does it for you, that inspires you to get outside of Tokyo and visit these smaller, more rural areas and experience the true level of adventure and the depth of Japanese culture that is available, then we will have accomplished something here today. I'm going to leave it right there for today. If this episode has given you any value at all, you know it would mean the absolute world to me if you would take 2 seconds to jump onto iTunes and leave a review for the podcast. I say it every time, but those reviews truly and genuinely do help me out, and I do love reading them, so I cannot wait to see what you have to write. Thank you so much for joining today. Don't forget, the video will be linked in the description below. I also recommend, for those of you who have stuck around to this point in the episode, a great piece of content focused on something around this topic that I really enjoyed doing here on the podcast was a podcast episode called Japan's Hidden Secret. I'm also, just for the sake of it, going to link that one in the description box of this podcast episode. Thank you once again for taking the time to join me for today's episode. I hope that the rest of your day and whatever you're doing is beautiful, and you know, I will talk to you again real soon.